the biggest problem with thought leadership, and this is only going to become more of a problem, is people don't want to spend time with their ideas, but expect you to spend time with their ideas.
Welcome back to the Startup Wisconsin podcast. In today's episode, we're sitting down with Dan Fogarty, a thought leadership strategist who helps founders and executives tell their stories more authentically on LinkedIn. Dan's got a fascinating background. He started in journalism at places like USA Today and the Boston Globe, but a boxing-related concussion led him to leave media and build his own business around content strategy. What makes Dan's approach different is how he brings a journalistic rigor to thought leadership. He's not about doing generic LinkedIn posts. Instead, he helps people find what's happening in the room, the insights that only come from being deeply embedded in your industry and the meetings that you have every single day. We talk about what's broken with thought leadership, his process for helping clients discover what's worth talking about, and his perspective as a recent transplant to Madison, Wisconsin. Plus, we'll get into his new AI tool, TalkBox, and his thoughts on what founders should be doing more of to tell Wisconsin's innovation story. And we're all about that. So let's jump into my conversation with Dan Fogarty.
So I started in journalism. I worked for some pretty big companies. When I first started, I worked for a blog in New York City that was very small. And so I got exposed to the internet. The financial crisis had just happened. It was 2009. The jobs outlook was in the gutter. I had just graduated college. And the only job I could get was writing for a blog. I actually went to school for marketing. I had minored in English. I'd always wanted to be a creative writer, and there wasn't any marketing jobs. And so I was just kind of like messing around, writing about the Knicks, living in New York City. And this blog kind of tapped me and said, "Do you want to write about sports?" And I said, "Hell yes." And then didn't get paid for like the first 6 months I was in that job, but it exposed me to the internet. It exposed me to writing a headline, to writing content, to capturing a moment, social media analytics, marketing the site, going to events. I did some TV hits. I was on the Jim Rome show on CBS Sports Network. I flew to LA. Exposed me to all these different things through that kind of first job where I like was getting paid nothing, but I got this just internet ground level floor seats kind of view of things. And then I got poached by USA Today. USA Today, like a lot of media companies and, you know, around kind of that like 2010, 2011 period, they're trying to figure out the internet, right? So they have these, they have this print product. They know they have to adapt. And so they kind of look around the room and they say, who's the youngest person we could hire that we could bring in to like tell us about the internet? But like, I knew just as much as them.
Yeah.
I knew some stuff, but like I was just coming in. I'm like, sure. That was my entryway into like a large journalistic outfit, right? Like I didn't go to journalism school. I kind of found my way into it. And then once I was there, I was around people who really knew this stuff, right? Like who knew how to tell a story, who knew how to build out these journalistic products. I was at USA Today for a while. I got poached by Boston Globe Media. Now I'm in like a real newsroom for Boston.com around, you know, writers and reporters who are breaking news, who are doing lifestyle restaurants. But yeah, there might be like, you know, some real important city journalism. There might be like an accident. There might be something that really matters. So I'm watching people report on deadline and having to tell these stories, but we're workshopping headlines where, you know, I'm helping them decide what stories to tell. So all of that kind of shaped my view of how to tell stories on the internet, that you have to stick to the truth. That was just ground into me. Yeah. That used to be a bigger deal. Now I hope is still a big deal, but yeah, it's a big deal. I still believe it's a big deal. But also how to package that. And when I say packaging, we'll get into this a little later, but basically you have to make sure that the story is optimized enough so that a busy person will stop and pay attention to it, but not oversold to the point that like you're killing your credibility.
Hmm.
So we're coming from an era of like content farms where I don't know if like you remember old like Outbrain was like this company that would have like, you know, content kind of on the side of whatever web page you clicked on. And a lot of this stuff has been cleaned up, but there's still like those like seedy corners of the internet where you get, you know, tricked into clicking on a headline, and now you're in like, you know, a slideshow of 50 worst ways to die, and you're getting sold like, you know, you know, erectile dysfunction pills, and there's all this like weird stuff happening, and you're like, how did I get into this weird corner of the internet? And so, you know, BuzzFeed obviously was popular at that point. They had a massive valuation. They had like a ton of money being invested into the company. They had kind of gamed the way that you told stories on social. I think as that company progressed, they learned how to ride that line better of not overpromising. But they really, it was like the companies like the New York Times were looking at these upstarts and saying, well, we know we need some of that, but if we go too far in that direction, we lose what our core brand is and what our core business is. And so that's kind of the outlook I have on content, which is you need to package it so that people that are meant to see it will see it. You can't just throw walls of text at people and expect them to like decipher your, you know, crazy Unabomber scribblings. But also, you can't go so far away from what it is you're actually talking about, right? Like you have to, you can't overpromise. You have to deliver on whatever that headline or hook or whatever you want to say is. So I spend time there, and 2016, I got a concussion. I was boxing at the time, just as a hobbyist. I was, you know, really into boxing. Got a concussion, was like so messed up from it that I couldn't do my job anymore. I couldn't, I was an editor at a busy news desk. So I would have reporters coming up to me. I would have Slack messages. I would have this thing on deadline, this thing on deadline. I'd have to go into a strategy session with the Boston Globe people to talk about our, you know, subscription strategy and distribution model and audience building. And so all these things are kind of crashing in on me, and my brain could not process all of it at once because of the injury. So I left. I had to, because I couldn't do the job anymore, and I figured it would be a matter of time before they fired me anyway. So I was kind of at this crossroads of my life. I had always wanted to write a novel. I had a little bit of money saved up. I said, okay, let me take my shot. I end up writing a novel about an MMA fighter with brain injuries and all this other kind of stuff thrown into it. The novel years later gets published, but at the time, my savings were running out. You're not just, nobody's just going to pay you to write a novel unless you're, you know, Jonathan Franzen and you've already done, or you're, you know, George R. R. Martin, or you've done stuff already and they're waiting for the next one. There's no money there. So I had to make money. Long-winded way of saying how I got into this, what I do is I'm still living in Boston. I'm like, okay, how can I make money from my core set of skills? Well, I know that there's a lot of businesses out there that are trying to figure out social media, but they're also trying to figure out storytelling. Thought leadership wasn't like as much of a thing back then. It wasn't this like generic term that gets, that everybody knows, but it's kind of just been beaten to death at this point. But people didn't know what content marketing or any of that stuff really was. But I would essentially go to businesses. I was going to like mom and pop catering companies. I was also emailing tech founders and AI guys from like MIT, like, hey, do you need help writing your blog? Do you need help doing this? Do you need help with your LinkedIn? Do you need help with your website copy? And so that's where it started. And I started getting these little rinky dink jobs and just kind of like $200, $300, $300, $200, $400, like just building, try to slowly to build that business, any kind of writing or any kind of content or social media or video that you needed for your business, how could I fit into that? So there's a certain amount of education that happened, a certain amount of selling, but it actually like allowed me to sit with some of these ideas and start to, you know, try to evolve them. At that time when I'm doing this, there is no AI. There's no even really AI transcription. I don't even think Otter existed at that point. And if it did, I didn't even know about it. So I'm literally talking on the phone or on Zoom with these guys. It's mostly guys because it's like tech dudes or rich guys. And I'm talking to them and I'm listening to the conversation. I'm recording it, but then I would have to go and spend 3 hours with the recording to kind of pour over, okay, this was said, this was said. And now I'm connecting the dots and I'm creating something. So there was no shortcut. It forced me to build that muscle memory, to build those neural connections with picking that stuff out. And now I've gotten good enough at it that I can kind of run that software in my head as you're talking.
Sure.
Like with my clients, I can kind of run that program, but do it in a way that allows you to get there. You don't want to short circuit it. I don't want to come in, and I'm sure I'll have some recommendations for content and how to do it and best practices, but I don't want to like be so prescriptive that I'm not going to let people not get to the idea themselves, because people have different ways of communicating.
Yeah.
So that's basically what turned into this business. It starts picking up steam around 2020, pandemic hits. I'm like, I had another full-time job as I was doing this on the side. The novel gets published around 2022, but around 2020, I'm like, okay, maybe I go all in on this. Maybe this is like the business I build. Maybe it's not just quite like a freelance side gig and now I'm doing this job. Let me go all in. And I think because of the pandemic and people being at home, they start to understand, wait a minute, LinkedIn is a source of information, right? Like thought leadership is a way that I can meet people, quote unquote, that are running these businesses and understand how they think. And it's not some corporate jargon or some brochure or some like marketing speak that got thrown together by five people on a call in New York. This is actually, I'm hearing from the people that are building the thing or selling the thing or out in front of the thing or researching the thing. And that's how you get to know people, right? Like just from this conversation, there's going to be people that listen to me that are going to be turned off. There's going to be other people that are going to be like, okay, some of what he said was smart and he seems kind of cool. Maybe at some point, if I need something, I would want to talk to him about that. That's kind of it. It's like a conversation you have with people. And that's what led me to here.
Was there like a specific moment where like you were like, this really makes sense? I'm going to go all in on this direction.
I'd worked in corporate, like I was in like journalism and working at these, you know, prestigious publications, but the jobs kind of saddled the line between like helping with the journalistic enterprise and a kind of a corporate junior executive type of thing where it's a lot of strategy meetings and a lot of like getting buy-in and a lot of red tape. And I was interested in how businesses were run, but I wanted exposure to other rooms. I wanted to like talk to other people or consult or do something where I had exposure to other businesses. I had all these things I wanted to be when I was 27, 28 years old. And I wanted exposure to those things. How could I do all of it? And what it started to click for me personally was when I started to talk to people who were from diverse forms of business, or who had different types of ideas or different sectors. And I was learning about AI when it was kind of this novel thing kind of floating around. And I was learning about, I don't know, HR tech or, you know, how to run a business and how to build a startup, because I'm talking to these people as they're doing it on the ground floor. I'm talking to these VCs about what they're seeing in the marketplace. That became tremendously interesting for me personally. It sort of became like a mini MBA where I'm getting exposure to all of these types of businesses and all of these different thinkers. That was exciting. I think though the turning point when I realize this is a business really is probably COVID, because people were at home and they spend more time on LinkedIn. They're spending more time on every social media network, but they're kind of getting that like professional fix. You could call it water cooler. You could call it trade talk panels, that kind of professional connectivity. And I do think people want to learn about industries and learn about their jobs and learn about what's going on.
Yeah.
That news feed started to become a place of congregation where people weren't just sharing what was happening during COVID, and it became a source of news. And people really started to, because the engagement was high and it was still kind of the Wild West with LinkedIn. At that point, even with the other social media sites, there was still a degree of like, well, if you don't have 50 million followers, this isn't really going to reach anybody, right? Like LinkedIn was still kind of the Wild West at that point. And so people would get tremendous amounts of engagement, whether it was sharing something personal or professional on the platform. And people started to see, okay, well, there's a way to do this where I can authentically talk about what I'm building. And I don't think that means you go full Facebook and you turn it into a confessional. I think it means these are my ideas. These are the ideas that kick around in my head when I'm sitting in that corporate meeting or when I'm running this company or when I'm out walking the dog. And I'm thinking about how this industry is shaped and how it operates and what it's going to look like in 3 to 6 months. And those aren't sales tactics. That's just a window into your brain. And if you can find that, if you can find that lane and you find that place in the Venn diagram between what you care about talking about, what other people want to ingest, and then what has to do with your company or enterprise, and you operate in the middle of that, that's powerful. And that's where I try to get to with my clients. And that's what I recommend to anybody who's trying to do this stuff. You want to kind of become your own publication. You want to become your own journalistic enterprise. Are you an Axios? Are you a BuzzFeed? Are you a New York Times? Are you an economist? What, Wall Street Journal? What are you? And there's no knock on any of those, right? Mm-hmm. It's just what are your values and principles? So I think when people started to see, okay, yeah, you've got like the engagement driven kind of schlocky stuff that's like designed as clickbait. Again, go back, roll the clock back to 2008, 2009. That stuff existed then. Mm-hmm. All of this is the same movie over again, by the way. All of this is from before you or I were even an idea to be born. Okay, go back to like tabloid newspapers. Go back to like, that stuff's always been there, riding the line between going too far in that direction, but also knowing that you have to make it engaging because people are busy, because they're coming from work and they're going to see the headline on your newspaper at the newsstand. But you have to determine what that line is between good taste and then stepping over the line and hurting your own credibility.
Yeah.
So people started seeing this and the numbers were insane. And that's, people needed time to see it. And they were at home and they had no choice but to see it. And they saw that it was leading to conversations, that these weren't vanity projects. This wasn't personal branding, which we'll talk about, but is like a term that I hate, and I'll tell you why I hate it. But this is a sharing of your ideas. Like, there's a reason that people want to be invited to the World Economic Forum, because you're being validated to some degree for your thoughts on what is shaping your industry in the world. That's cool. That's not just you posting a selfie and like, on my way to work, got my Starbucks, like da 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 da. Like, okay, that's cool. Lifestyle content is absolutely part of the picture for some people, and there's stuff that I do around that. But when you can clearly be seen for your ideas, that makes you trustworthy. That makes people want to do business with you.
Yeah.
Even if you already work for a brand that's already terrific. Okay. Even if you already work for a whatever, name any brand, Nike, they've taken a bit of a hit over the years, but that's a consumer brand. But any B2B brand, name Monday.com, Recovery.com locally. These are great brands. And also, I want to know, what's the chief growth officer think about this over the next 3 to 6 months? Because that's who I'll probably be working with, right? Or their head of enterprise, or I want to know what their founder thinks. I want to know what Ben thinks. I want to know what does it look like for this company over the next however amount of months? What are they seeing in the industry? What tactics can they share? Because they're in it every day. And that's valuable information. So people started to get it. And that's when I said, not only is this something I want to do because of the mini MBA aspect, but there is a actual business here.
So let's talk about thought leadership.
Yeah. Let's get into it, man.
Everyone has this idea of what it is. It's a term that's been floated around for quite a while. But from your perspective, like, you know, what is broken or boring about it, and what are people getting wrong?
There's a few common mistakes that people make with thought leadership. One is that they just sell. They think that thought leadership is like tricking you into telling you about their company or product.
Like a bad webinar.
Like a timeshare.
Like a timeshare.
You know, I'm going to invite you into this post, but you ain't leaving until you say yes to the time. Like, no, people don't want that. They don't want to be sold to in that way. Another issue is people don't know what to talk about. They don't know how to connect the ideas that kind of swim around in their head when they're out for a walk or they're in the boardroom to like what is happening in the room and in the industry in real time, or connect it to current events, or connected to an outlook, or provide to basically treat themselves as a journalistic publication, which sounds haughty and it sounds hard. But that's really my job. My job is to kind of come in and just take what you say, ask you the right questions that a journalist would ask you, and distill from that and crystallize that. What are the things that are actually of value that an audience wants, right? And also has to do with your business. But yeah, those are two of the big ones. There was a third one. The biggest problem with thought leadership, and this is only going to become more of a problem, is people don't want to spend time with their ideas, but expect you to spend time with their ideas. So let me say that again. They don't want to spend any time with these ideas. They don't want to spend time with the discomfort of forming an idea, which sometimes can be uncomfortable. They want to just put it out, but they want you to stop the scroll, click more, watch the video, read the 10 lines of text or the 30 lines of text, and then give you the trust, give you their time. I spent 8 years writing a novel that most people finish in about 2 weeks. I designed it that way to be a thriller. It's got to move fast, but I spent 8 years for you to spend 2 weeks with me. That's the bargain. Now, I'm not saying if you're running a company that you have to be James Baldwin or Ernest Hemingway or Tom Wolfe, right? Or Sally Rooney or whoever. You don't have to pore over every idea and suffer and be neurotic. There's a time when you can get too precious with your ideas. What I am saying is you have to spend enough time with it so that you kind of follow it and you find it, right? Like it might come to you fully formed. It might just be a voice note that you record and boom, that's kind of it. And it's just so in there because of your muscle memory and it's like really novel to other people who are outside your bubble. That's valuable. But in general, if you are just using ChatGPT, if you are just using Claude, and you're trying to do this perfectly packaged post every single time that is following the same sentence structures as everybody else, it's got the same kind of words in there, it's got the telltale signs, and people are seeing it, and worse yet, you've spent less time with it than you expect other people. That's like me trying to make a cake that I spend 5 minutes on, and it's out of the oven, and it's still glop, it hasn't even baked, and I say, eat it.
Yeah,
and you're like, no. And I'm like, no. It's thought leadership. It's valuable. Eat it. And you're like, no, there's other cake I could buy. I don't understand. Why are you offering me this glop? Yeah. And that's the problem. That's the biggest problem. And it's only going to become more of a problem.
So how do you help like a founder, for example, find out like what's worth talking about?
That's a great question. So there are certain things. I'm going to give you the process that I go through with clients. And then there are like some other kind of buckets that generally, not all the time, but generally can work. Some other kind of tips, tricks, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
So I'll just talk about kind of the generalized tips and tricks first. Look at your Google Calendar over the past 3 weeks. Just open it up. Look at the meetings you had, the conversations you had. Was there anything interesting there? Take time with it. Be intentional because were you talking to investors? Did you do a pitch? Were you talking to potential customers? Did you have a team call about the product? What was in there? You probably have call transcripts. There's probably stuff in there that you can pick out from there. Now, whenever you do this, whenever you use content from this, you always want to make sure that if it's a call transcript, that the people you were talking to know that it was being recorded, right? You want to kind of focus on what you said. But just as a thought exercise to kind of spark an idea, what interesting things happen? What makes an investor lean in when you pitch? What makes a customer actually kind of light up when you talk about the product? Because a lot of founders have trouble just even talking about what they do. So you're kind of out in the world A/B testing the messaging already. Now you kind of know, okay? So that's kind of step one. Another thing is just read journalism about your industry. Okay, read, I don't care if it's Wired, I don't care if it's a niche Substack about HR tech, I don't care, whatever it is that you like, could be Scott Galloway, could be something much smaller and concentrated. Think about it, listen to podcasts, ingest content around it, and that will start to spark ideas. You will have ideas from their ideas, okay? Like you will start to see, oh, okay, wait, well, Galloway was just talking about this thing happening in the market. Well, actually, like that reminds me of this thing. So that's a great way. I like keeping a notebook, idea capture, or just emailing yourself, like just things that pop in your head. They don't have to be fully formed. I did this when I was writing the novel. I was just like, guy, green shirt, subway, looks unhappy. That would bring up something for me when I went back later and looked at it. Maybe it was a scene, maybe it was a character, maybe it was a piece of dialogue, maybe it was nothing and I threw it away. But I'm capturing some of those ideas, okay? Yeah. Another thing is if you listen to podcasts like The Daily, The Daily had a roundtable of business journalists. These are the tippy top journalists, New York Times business journalists. They're talking about the tariffs when the tariffs are first starting to hit. And they talk about it. Now, these are journalists. They're like by the book journalists. So you can't necessarily say to them, hey, what's going to happen? What's Trump going to do? What's going to happen tomorrow? Because they're going to tell you, I don't know. And it would be irresponsible of me to tell you. But, and a lot of executives, particularly at larger companies, fall into that boat, right? Mm. But what you can do is you can give an outlook for 3 to 6 months. And you can couch it. You can say, this is scenario A, this is scenario B. This is best case, this is medium case, this is worst case. You can couch it. But you can do it with a degree of expertise and knowing what you're talking about. By doing that, you are showing, not telling. You are showing them, I know what I'm talking about. And you're not saying, look, I know about supply chain, okay? If anybody knows about supply chain, I don't know what that impression was. Where did that come from? But you're not just saying, I know this thing. You're showing that you're in the room. You're showing that you know about it. You're showing that you've thought about it, right? Okay? So those are kind of like boilerplate things you can try to do. I would also just walk outside and record a voice note and start talking. I think that's valuable. It's going to feel super weird, super weird. I think you should do it while you're walking so you don't have to feel the existential dread of standing in a room talking by yourself.
Pacing in
circles. This isn't Taxi Driver, okay? Yeah, get out of the house, walk around the block, okay? But you do that, that starts getting things going. You're going to come out of meetings. You're going to be like, oh, that's something. There's something, or I just had an interaction. People are social. Through these collisions of ideas and concepts, you're going to have things kind of organically happen. Now, how do I do it formally with a client? I sit down with them. We have an hour-long kickoff. And what I do in the kickoff is I say, okay, what are your business goals for the next 3 to 6 months? What does it look like? Tell me about this quarter. Tell me about next year. Irrespective of marketing. Doesn't have to do anything with marketing or content. I don't want to hear how many followers you want or engagement, which is a whole nother conversation. I want to know the business. What are you willing to tell me? Tell me what I don't know about this business and what you want to have happen in this business. So have an honest conversation with yourself. Maybe that's leads. Maybe that's raising a Series A. Maybe that's landing some kind of enterprise client. Maybe that's making a big splash with a hire or rolling out a product. I don't know, but be honest with yourself about the business. Okay, now, this thing is happening. We've established these three things, these home runs that you want to hit, okay? This hire you want to make or this funding you want to get or whatever. Who are the audiences for these different objectives, okay? Mm-hmm. It might be coastal VCs. It might be private equity firms. It might be other tech leaders that you want to poach. It might be customers that you want. It might be, you know, enterprise clients that you want to hear your message. Who are these people? It's going to flow naturally from that first question. Get specific. If you can, you know, you don't have to do a full persona exercise, but like, who are these people? You know who they are because you've been in the room with them, probably. Like maybe you've had no contact with them and you've only got some idea, but usually you've like sort of started to pitch to these people already. So you know them, you know their pain points, you know what they care about. Let's have a conversation about that. Then it makes ideating content a lot easier because you know who you're talking to. That's really the central question you always have to come back to is who are you talking to? Mm-hmm. Then it becomes, this is where like I kind of come in and I get you talking about things that we know that this audience cares about. But we're not talking about like how great your product is or why they should invest in you or whatever. That's like, it's too on the nose and people don't want to be sold to and it starts to feel like a brochure. But if you say that you are an expert in manufacturing or you're an expert in staffing in this region, okay, you're an expert in staffing. Let's talk about the jobs report. Just came out last week. What do you see in the numbers? Okay, what are you hearing on the ground from, oh, you hire, chiefs of marketing at high growth startups, that's what your staffing agency focuses on, or you focus on like manufacturing companies in the Midwest and you're hiring for this role, What are the common misconceptions that these companies don't get right when they're trying to hire? What is the playbook for trying to get to this eventuality that you help customers get to? And then people's eyes kind of light up because they realize, oh, wait a second, I'm in the room. I see this stuff every day. I see stuff that other people don't see. And that is what you have to get to. What is happening in the room? I talk about this all the time. It's a concept that people are tired of hearing about it, but it's what is central to getting this right is what is happening in the room. And that's what a journalist does. A journalist takes people into rooms that they otherwise do not have access to. Whether you're talking about NBA trades like Luka Doncic to the Lakers, or you're talking about trade negotiations with China, or you're talking about, you know, DeepSeek coming out and like the uproar in Silicon Valley, what it means for AI, and are we going to still be buying this kind of chip? Like, that's what good journalists go to the source, and they find people who are in the room. Well, you're in the room, so let's talk about what you are in the room for, because if you've got something good, that's people are going to want to like be in that room with you. And that's, it's almost like, it's like a playbook, a mini case study, but it's also an exposure to your brain and how you think about this and how you communicate. That's the best thing you could ask for. That is gold. Because now the person that's going to buy from you sees how you think, sees how you operate, or the VC who's going to invest in you, or the person who's thinking about, oh, I might work at this company or whatever, they're seeing you. And you're just saying who you are, and they're saying what you think, and you're saying what you see. And that's all it is. It's a relay of that.
Today's episode is brought to you by Headway, a digital product agency based in Wisconsin. Do you need to design and build a world-class user experience for your software, but feeling like you just can't get there on your own? That's where Headway comes in. We're the folks who help ambitious startups and enterprise teams bring their product ideas to life through design, development, and product strategy. We don't just give you user interface designs and leave you to figure out the rest. We work with you and your target customers to create beautiful user experiences, build scalable design systems, and provide Silicon Valley level talent to get it done right the first time. Whether you're launching a new software or just looking to add features, we've got your back. We've worked with startups in industries like logistics, healthcare, fintech, and edtech, helping them solve their biggest software challenges. And here's the thing, no matter how complex your product is, we can help you gain clarity and get the job done together. We're so confident that we'll be the right fit that we offer a 50% money back guarantee if you don't think we're working out within the first 45 days. Ready to see how we can help you and your team? Just head over to headway.io and book a free consultation today.
When a founder's like, okay, them as an individual posting through their profile on LinkedIn, like that kind of is like establishing this, you know, quote unquote personal brand that the internet has kind of like labeled. But then there's the company brand.
Yeah.
So how do you help them kind of like bridge the gaps or just understand the differences there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that think about it how it is in real life.
Yeah.
Okay. Ben from recovery.com is a really good example.
Okay.
Like when you see Ben talk about the company, something happens. Like when you're in the room with him and he is talking about his team, he's talking about the mission, he's talking about the product, and he's talking about the industry and kind of some of the problems with the industry, something happens. It's like a different Ben from the Ben that you're just like, oh, this is a cool guy, we're just talking, whatever. And then something happens. Something probably happens with you in relation to that brand. Like when you talk about it, there's something that is in there that you are intellectually stimulated by, passionate about, that intersects with who you are as a person, right? That's kind of what we're looking for. And there's also ICP considerations, right? So if you're the chief growth officer or you're selling into enterprise, like that's a big part of it, right? Like we're going to talk about enterprise problems in the industry and pain points, right? And factors that you have to bring in if you are a large scale, whatever, right? That's what we're going to hone in on. So it's who you are in relation to the thing, but it's also like, who are you talking to? Because some founders are very technology driven. Some founders are really good salespeople. Some founders are an extension of the brand. The brand is them. And so it's easy, but I think it's kind of, it goes back to that Venn diagram thing. Like, I don't think people want to hear from companies. I want to be careful here because company pages on LinkedIn or brands themselves still have a place. They're kind of still the facilitator. It's like inside the MBA is a brand. But it works so well because of Charles Barkley, Shaq, Ernie Johnson, and Kenny Smith, the guys that lend this thing knowledge, expertise, and personality. They're the humans behind it. So how can we tell that story? How can we tell your story where it kind of runs in conjunction with the company?
Yeah.
But again, it's like, I hate the term personal brand because that makes it feel like a vanity project. I think, screw personal brand. Don't think about personal brand. What are your values? What do you care about?
Yeah.
Why did you start this thing? Or why do you work here? Or why do you care about this work?
Yeah.
Or what stimulates you about it intellectually? Like, come back to that. Come back to the inner calculus that occurs. Do not think about branding. You are not a branding exercise. You're a person.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of conversations around people finding their identity in what they do and not who they are. And so, like, I think there's a lot of, like, just opportunity. Like, obviously, you can talk about skill set and things like that. But there's something to be said about when people just start bringing themselves through in their writing, like their actual like feelings about stuff and how like they just, again, it's like that personal perception versus just like me as a CTO versus me as me.
Yeah.
Like this is how I really feel about this stuff that's happening versus like objectively this, but subjectively that.
How would you talk about your business or your industry or your thing or your job over cocktails? Or if you don't drink, how would you talk about it at
over
a baseball
coffee.
Game or over coffee or you're taking a walk? You may not want to share all that on the internet. In fact,
it's
I would
true.
Recommend not sharing all that on the internet. But there's a certain, you start to see the person in relation to the thing. It starts to come through.
Yeah.
So your content should be an extension of that. Again, like you're not just like throwing stuff out there. You're not sharing state secrets. It's more the way you communicate, and you get it out of your head that you're all of a sudden doing like a marketing thing. Like if you start thinking about it as like a marketing thing, it could start to get jargony. It could start to get awkward. It could start to just like not feel right.
Yeah.
But when you're just talking about your job with peers or a friend, and you're not like, there's not a camera on you, and you're not like sitting down, like I have to do a thought leadership now. Like, what is that? And I think that comes out through conversations. I think that comes out when another person is talking to you and asking you questions with real genuine curiosity, and that your streams of consciousness, the ways that you speak, your linguistic fingerprint, the words you use, your modes of communicating, and like your actual passion or intellectual stimulus from talking about the thing comes out. If you can capture that, which is the whole crux of my business, that is kind of what you're looking, that's the personal side of it. It doesn't mean you go full Facebook and you turn into a confessional and it's all person. It's just like, that can be too much. That can be too intimate. That can almost feel transactional by way of intimacy. You don't want that. This isn't about manipulation. This is about really actually talking about the thing conversationally. Conversationally doesn't mean dumbed down, by the way. Conversationally means comes out of you, right? It's real. How can you do that in an intellectually sound way, in a professional way, but kind of toe that line?
Yeah. It just makes me think about, because you were sharing, it's been a little while since you first shared it, but speaking of conversations, the AI tool that you're kind of working on with some of your clients and that you're building is exactly leveraging like that kind of like approach. Like, okay, we're going to have a conversation and this tool is going to help us figure out like what stories or what angles can we pull out of this conversation? Like where's your story within all this stuff, or what can you produce for content in this quarter from all this conversation? Do you want to like maybe share like how you approach that, or like how the idea came to be? I'm kind of curious.
Well, like most people, when AI first came out, I said, how can I get rich?
Yeah.
How can I not have to work anymore? How can I make this machine do everything I do? So the idea started from that extremely selfish idea, that line of thought. And I just moved to Madison. I was in the level set program at Starting Block. And I was like, okay, I think the thing I want to build is just an extension of me. It's AI, but can I use all of the journalistic expertise I have, the way that I ask questions, the kind of the formats I have, the kind of kickoff format, and then I kind of segue into this, and I've got this module, and I have this process. How can I put that into an AI? Because then I want to scale my business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I learned in my customer research, talking to clients, talking to people in the field, talking to people I've never worked with before, is that you could build the best content tool on the planet, best marketing tool on the planet, and there is an audience for it if they're just using it one-to-one. But most people want an expert in the loop. They want an editor-in-chief of their newsroom. Mm-hmm. So if the AI is doing the busy work, like it's taking what we talk about and it's turning that into a post, you still want that editor-in-chief to be working with you to say, well, I would take out this part, I would take out this part, I would reframe this part.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called TalkBox. TalkBox is a tool where I'm talking to you, we're in a Google Meet, TalkBox is running, we press record, it records, I just have a conversation with you, I ask you questions, I go through my whole process, I ask you questions a journalist would ask you. And then TalkBox, because we've programmed it with prompts, all my prompts built up over the years in the back end, it generates a draft of a LinkedIn post, a Substack article, any piece of written content you want, even business books. You could start to experiment with that. And it should be 95% of the way there.
Hmm.
Sometimes it's 100% of the way there. But you still want somebody with you to A, get those streams of consciousness out of you, would be to kind of like walk you through it and tell you like, no, this is good, or I think we should flesh this out a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of be your content strategist on the back end, kind of
sure.
Be your journalist on the back end. Now, I think there's going to be tools that, in fact, there are some tools out there that you can use on a one-to-one level that you just talk to and it asks, the AI asks you questions, there's a conversational element, and you use it. I think that's great for a lot of people, for a lot of solo founders, for people that kind of understand content already.
Yeah.
That's a great tool. I think there is a large swath of people for whom they still want humans in the loop. And I think in general with AI, that's going to be the case. You're going to have an addressable market that is cool with just using this health tech feature, this content feature, this marketing thing, this coding thing,
yeah,
by themselves, because they either have some institutional knowledge or they're comfortable with just doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's plenty of people out
there.
And
they have taste.
And they have taste, or they have, and I think even the people that want a person there have taste, but they may not have the institutional knowledge or like they're probably going to want a therapist working with them on the AI tool. They're going to want somebody who understands development and coding to like be pulling the levers and knowing what buttons to press. And I think with AI in general, that's going to be a pretty big market. And so that really is how I approach this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and building out TalkBox. I think when you're talking about software, obviously the product itself is going to matter a ton. It's number one, but so is data. So is kind of the lead you've built already, but so also is relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships matter. Face-to-face relationships matter. The feeling you get by talking to another human being matters. How can we maximize that and maximize the expertise that people have while also maximizing the AI doing the busy work? So Dan doesn't have to go home and like listen to the recording and like pull out the threads.
Yeah, yeah.
Pre-otter, pre-transcript, right? Those are the products I'm excited about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm actually kind of curious, just because your background's in writing, like, how do you feel about just like, I mean, obviously, it's nice when you don't have to do the busy work, but do you feel like I'll never let AI replace, like, me doing writing as a practice?
Right. Yeah, there are certain things that are off limits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I kicked around the idea of, well, if I wrote another novel, would I use AI in any capacity? I have some feelings about this. I think for one, certain things are untouchable, not because there's a necessarily a boundary, but because the machines can't get to it yet. And I think if you go back and you read James Baldwin, who is pound for pound, I think the best writer that's ever lived, and you look at the way that he communicates and then he writes, some of it is style and technique. A lot of it is things that he felt in his body and things that he witnessed and ideas that formulated around those feelings that really, because he was a one of one mind, could have only ever been expressed by James Baldwin. That is what makes really, really great. I hate even using the word content, like James, you know, around James Baldwin's work, but like any kind of like great movie or even a great newspaper article has a sense of time and place and feeling. You could read some kind of, even going back to the NBA trade example, like you could read an ESPN article about the Lakers GM and the Mavericks GM kind of cooking up this trade, and it starts like in a coffee shop in Dallas, and that's a sense of place and like the feelings and the anxieties and the things around this. But going back to James Baldwin, like that is a one of one thing that even if you tried, you couldn't reproduce. You could have an AI try to write a James Baldwin novel, but that inner uncanny valley as a human, you're going to feel it. You're going to be repulsed by the fact that it's like video game graphics from like 1998 on Sega CD, where it's like photorealistic, but you're like, I don't like this. Something about this is weird. Like, that's what turns on in you when you see a piece of content that you know is AI. At the same time, I do think there are going to be works of art, Star Wars movies, but even like The Brutalist was an Academy Award winning prestige movie that had AI generated buildings in the background because it just would have cost way too much to have that detail otherwise. So I think there will be high level artists that use AI to do some of the busy work because they understand those processes of like maybe research or details, or I have a setting in upstate New York. Let me quickly research all of the types of trees that exist in upstate New York. So as I'm writing, you know, backdrop copy around this, like kind of setting the scene of the scene, I know that it is accurate. Or let me run my work through the AI to make sure that, you know, all of the seasons line up, and that when I said a scene was set during the day, I didn't say that later on it was at night, or that this character had red hair and later on it had black hair. There's like a certain amount of, again, it's like having research assistants and copy editors. How can you use it in that way? Now, I don't know. We might get to a place where there is some content that has a special stamp. There might be movies produced in Hollywood that there might be a committee that awards a certain kind of stamp to movies that are 100% organic. Just same way we have organic food. There are certain novels, movies, high level art that is 100% organic and gets that stamp. If you're the Brutalist and you used AI to do some of that, those buildings in the background, tough luck. Sorry, I know Adrian Brody's in the movie, but no, it doesn't get the stamp. So I think there's that aspect. I also am interested to see in how more IRL stuff, culture, people might start to come back to that. There might, you might see a resurgence in local theater. See a resurgence. There's already a resurgence in comedy, but these are experiences that you could see in a TikTok clip, but like when you're in the room, it's different.
I'm kind of curious how you think about just being in Madison, because you lived on the East Coast and then you came over here to Madison, I'm assuming because of your partner. So I'm just kind of curious what your experience has been so far in like the Madison startup community.
I love it. I love this place. My wife decided to go back to school for her master's in social work. She's from the area. She's from Stoughton. I'd visited a couple times. The first time she ever took me to Madison, it was in February. She took me to a GameStop in a strip mall. And I said, never again. Don't ever take me back here. I was like, this is like a bad part of New Jersey. I can get this at home.
Do you need any water?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
Just brings back memories. So, but once we made the decision to move here, I knew I wanted to try because I had spent time in Boston. I'm born and raised in New York. I love New York. I don't think there's a higher concentration of human talent in the world. I think if you're in your 20s and you're trying to be an actor or you're trying to be a writer or you're trying to be a business person or start a fashion brand or go into finance, there's just no better place to be. And you just like, it exposes you to so many different things professionally and personally and romantically that you just, there's no other tonic like that in the world. If you can afford to live there, if you can make it happen, if like, it's just getting increasingly hard to live there. And I think a lot of people, me, my friends included, it started to just become like a survive thing. Like you're not going to a Broadway show every night. You're not going to the best new restaurants. You're kind of just like trying to just live there and stay there. And I think with my injury, I'd had a brain injury in 2016. It was so stimulating and it wasn't necessarily healthy for me. So when she said, hey, I'm thinking, you know, what do you think about Madison? I was like, hell yeah. There's lakes, there's trees, there's still a startup community, there's still good restaurants. I can bike a lot of places. We can go hiking. We can just go walk our dog. The dog parks here, the size of state parks. It's incredible. So when I first got here, I was like, this is amazing. This is great. And I think, I mean, I talked to a lot of people that work here that maybe have some civic tie to the place that are kind of in the Wisconsin ecosystem. And one thing that I talk about is there's like a gap between if you're a student or if you're like settling down and you're in a committed relationship or you're getting ready to marry. That's kind of those are like the sweet spots. And older folks too have a great time here. But like if you're in your 20s, I don't know if I was single in my 20s, I don't know if I would have the same reaction. But I do know that when I moved here and I was with my wife and I was just around this place and I could bike to a Father John Misty concert at the Sylvie and pass by some lakes and I could go hiking on the weekend and I didn't have to have my head on a swivel all the time like I did in New York City. And there wasn't this crushing anxiety of just simply surviving. Even beyond that, the people here were genuinely kind. I know the Midwest nice thing gets talked about a lot, but I guess I've gotten some of that, but I really have found that people in Madison are genuinely kind, not fake nice, and they genuinely will have a coffee with you. They genuinely will give you their time in a way that in New York just simply doesn't happen. So also Midwest nice isn't all that bad. Like, you know, East Coast people, I love the East Coast. I love my blunt East Coast people.
Yeah.
There's no better thing than that. But there's times if I'm in the parking lot at the Walgreens, I don't want to hear your blunt take on it. I don't know you, man. Back up. Give me the Midwest nice in that scenario. There's sometimes that the politeness, I like the politeness, you know, give me the politeness. And I think I was ready for the politeness. So, but that's, I'm saying that jokingly, but people are, they're open here.
Mm-hmm.
And in New York, you have to have a shield all the time.
Yeah. Who was the first person to kind of invite you in, it felt like they were inviting you into the startup community? Or did you just kind of like, I'm just going to show up to this thing? Like, what was your kind of path into the startup community?
Leslie at Starting Block is amazing. If you've never met Leslie and you're moving here, you're thinking about moving here. It was before I moved here. I had a call with her about Starting Block because I was looking at it as a co-working space. And eventually it becomes this place that I end up doing a kind of a accelerator at. But Leslie is just so funny and so amazing and so welcoming. And she was one. I would say Cliff McDonald at recovery.com. That's somebody whose input and advice and the way he sees things I respect immensely. He's also, he grew up in Boston, and so there's that East Coast transplant thing. He's just like, I mean, this guy's, he's a football coach, he's a former football player, he's a super smart guy, he's an athlete.
Yeah.
And like, you, I'm just like, this is a guy I want to listen to, and you know, I'll follow into battle kind of thing. He's super cool. Those are two people who I think were extremely cool and kind of informed early on how I saw this place and what this place could be. Who else? What other shout outs could I give? If anybody else comes to mind, I'll tell you, but those are the two kind of big ones.
Yeah. What was the first kind of like social like gathering you went to? Like, was it like something at Starting Block, or I'm just kind of curious what kind of event?
It was the Father John Misty concert at the Silby.
Okay.
It was like the night I moved here with my wife, we went to a Father John Misty concert at the Silby, and I walked in and I was like, well, this is nice. This is like a, this is a venue you would find in a major world-class city. And, oh, there's an artist that only travels to major world-class cities. And well, these people are pretty nice. See, these people around me seem pretty nice. You know, I don't feel like I have to like get ready to fight. This is cool. Nice. And so I was just like, cool. Okay. I like this. And it was a nice way to kind of ease into being here. But I do think, regardless of where you move, making friends as an adult is hard, and building a social calendar as an adult is hard. And I learned this, you know, as a guy in kind of my mid-20s, moving to a mid-sized city where like I kind of just expected things to happen. Mm-hmm. But I literally created a Google Doc before I moved to Madison of all the communities that I was going to throw myself into.
Really?
Yeah. So startup community. So I knew I was going to go to Starting Block. There was going to be programming there, people there.
Yeah,
there was a thing I could plug into. Like fitness and martial arts. I wanted to find the boxing gyms around here. I don't get hit in the head anymore. I don't spar, but I do hit the heavy bag, and I do like to be part of that culture.
Yeah,
so I found the boxing gym. Theater. I'm into, I like acting. I like doing theater. So like, who's making exciting theater, you know? My friend Matt Raines is a really great director and actor living in Madison. And I was going to audition for one of his plays, but we ended up just being buddies. He was like my first friend
nice.
In Madison. He was awesome. And so it was like I had to go in with a plan of how to find these different communities and really put myself out there. But I was writing down places I wanted to try to eat. Parks I wanted to go to, communities I wanted to be a part of. So I did come in with a plan.
I'm actually curious about your perspective on the founder community here and what you feel like, you think founders should be doing more. Like founders should be leaning into this. I just your observations of from Boston, New York City, and then coming here and just your experience with founders at Starting Block. What do you feel like founders should be doing more of and that they're not really doing?
This is going to be completely biased, so I'll give you the biased answer and then I'll try to answer it more broadly.
Sure.
I think they should be telling their story more. I think that if you want to, there's all this talk about like the Madison startup community and the Midwest startup community and like hand-wringing about are people investing enough here? Are there enough big companies here? Blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, Epic's the only big company or this or that. It's like, I think we have to tell the story, and it's not like some civic outfit that's going to just tell that story. I think we as individuals need to talk about what we're building and why. And I think also like what you're doing right here is a great example, having people in conversation, right? Like having these collisions of ideas. And I think just continuing to build on that. I mean, Founder Day is tomorrow. The Capital Entrepreneurs are putting on this great event. And that thing is just steadily growing. How can we just continue to build these spaces where people can collide? And then how do we amplify the story? And not in like a salesy brochure type way.
Yeah.
But in a way that's like, this is just what's happening. This is just what's happening. This is just what's happening. Now, a bunch of other questions about like capital and large companies and just all that. There's even broader questions about Madison, the city, right? Like, what is the city going to look like in 5 years? What is the city going to look like in 10 years? Oh, is it going to be like Austin or like this or like that? Yeah. Like, it's like a popular talking point, but there's all these issues with housing. And this coming from somebody who loves the place, I think people in Madison need to decide. I don't know how you do that. I think you just kind of come together. But like, if you don't decide what the city's going to be, it might be some like tech boys fever dream, or it like with just like tons of apartments and co-working spaces that look like bad WeWorks, and then the soul of the place dies. Or it might look like just nothing, like nothing happens, and like people get like, there's no new housing, people don't get built, and like the NIMBY crowd takes over, and like there's this, I don't know, I'm not saying anything is bad or good. I'm just saying that if you don't decide what your city's going to be, because I do feel like the city's at an inflection point, it will just, it's just going to happen. And somebody else is probably going to decide that. Developers are going to decide that. Tech people are going to decide that. I don't know, like people who are involved in the civic side of things. I don't know too much about that, but they're going to get involved with that. So I do think that there's kind of a inflection point for this place. And what I hope is that we lean into this. Is I'm a total newbie. I am a evil, bad, dirty coastal city slicker. Okay. So take this with a grain of salt. And by the way, when I moved to Boston, I was like, well, this is how Boston should do. If you want to piss people off, have a New Yorker come into Boston and start talking about like the way things should be. I learned my lesson, folks. It's not going to happen again. But but I think, how do I want to say this? Like, you have things that only you have. You have an isthmus. You have lakes. I think I think it's the only city on an isthmus besides Seattle. You have this beautiful confluence. You have one of the most amazing campuses, the energy from UW. Yeah. I go to women's volleyball games. I go to men's basketball games. I could pay $20 to see a 12th ranked men's basketball team play. I could go to Camp Randall. I could watch the football team. Alabama comes here to play football. Like, that's world class. You have a pro sports team.
Yeah, yeah.
With the NIL, you actually do have a pro sports team. And you have a pro sports team, and you have this campus, and like, there's a great vintage clothing kind of movement here. There's great local theater here. There's people putting on really great work. There's really great local media. I was shocked by how good, as a media person, I was like, I love Madison Magazine, Madison Minutes, the CityCast Madison podcast. This is like local news and local journalism and local media. And there's so much pride in this place. And so how do you take all the things, all the natural gifts that this place has? How do you take the kind of cultural things that it does well and the vibe, the brand of the place, and lean in and double down on those things and make sure that everybody gets taken along on the ride, that it's inclusive and that people are brought along for it and that it's fair and that it's like actually a fair place to live for people? How do you bring that? Because I'm not saying that some of the tech guy fever dream stuff isn't good, or that we don't need more VC capital or whatever it is. Like, yeah, you need a mix. You need a mix. But if you don't also double down on those cultural things and those like human soul things and those livability things that make this place great, then it just becomes a copy and paste of like a WeWork and like luxury buildings that are lame. Like,
yeah.
And luxury buildings are cool. But like, if the whole freaking thing looks like a bad luxury building, you lose something.
Yeah. Like, how do you keep growing a city without changing its character?
Yes. And you can't be so conservative that you don't want to answer the question because people will answer it for you. Sharks are circling the lakes, my friends. Okay. They're going to make those choices for you.
Yeah.
Or if you stymie the sharks and you stop the sharks and nothing happens, well, then congratulations, nothing happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. And I'm not one to say this needs to be New York City, that you need like, you know, industrial style warehouses that like look like they're from Berlin and we're playing tech music at 2 a.m. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah. This doesn't need to be an oasis for 25-year-olds. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah. Right? I like my peace and quiet. What I'm saying is, take what you do well already, which are so many things, and the things that I mentioned, which is only a slight piece of it, and double down on those things. Invest in those things and make sure people are brought along for the ride. Don't leave people behind.
You said a lot today.
I'll be running for mayor.
So how do people, you know, find out about you, the services you offer? Just give us the rundown how people can get in contact with you.
Yeah, go to IamDanFogarty.com. I am Dan Fogarty. That's Fogarty with an A. I think probably the best way, though, that's if you want to work with me, great. Just follow me on LinkedIn. I talk about a lot of this stuff on LinkedIn. I share best practices for storytelling for businesses, thought leadership, all that stuff on LinkedIn. So follow me on LinkedIn. It's Fogarty. send me a message if you want to talk. Open book.
All right, cool. Thanks again, Dan. It was good.
Thank you, Jacob.
All right.
Thank you, team.
Thank you, team.
Thanks for joining us on the Startup Wisconsin podcast. Want to support the show? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates. If you're feeling generous, you can share, rate, and review our podcast to help others find us. All right, folks, until next time, let's keep moving Wisconsin forward.